Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, June 25th. Let's start with Europe and Greece. This coming week, we will determine whether the European Union and Eurozone get to kick the can down the road another few months, max, or whether there is a run on the bank, literally. Greek Prime Minister Papandreou won a confidence vote for his reshuffled government, and his cabinet put together a new $112 billion austerity program of further tax hikes, cuts in spending, pay, and pensions, as well as a speeded-up privatization program, all of which gained the approval of the EU and IMF. But now Parliament has to approve the plan in order for Greece to get $17 billion from the EU that would allow Greece to meet its obligations in July. The vote in Parliament is expected to be exceedingly tight, with Greece's opposition opposed because, in their view, the further austerity cuts will throw the economy into depression. They favor a plan of tax cuts, including to the value-added tax as well as corporate rates, as a way of stimulating the economy and thus tax revenues. Should Parliament, against current consensus, vote the Papandreou plan down, global equity markets will crash, and it will take every emergency measure possible to limit the damage. European Central Bank President Jean-Claude Trichet called the situation a code red. The message of the board is that the link between debt problems and banks is the most serious threat to financial stability in the European Union, he said. Martin Feldstein, Financial Times. Even though the Greek Parliament has given the government some breathing space with its vote of confidence, a default by Greece is inevitable. With a debt-to-gross domestic product ratio of more than 150%, I would add it's going to 166% next year, large annual deficits and interest rates more than 25%, the only question is when the default will occur. The current negotiations are really about postponing the inevitable. If Greece were the only insolvent European country, it would be best if its default occurred now. Cutting its debt in half and replacing the existing debt with low interest rate bonds would allow Greece to service its debt without the excruciating pain that would be involved if it tried to service its current debt. But Greece is not alone in its insolvency, and a default by Athens could trigger defaults by Portugal, Ireland, and possibly Spain. The resulting losses would destroy large amounts of the capital banks and other creditors in Germany, France, and other countries. There would be a drying up of credit available to businesses throughout Europe, and there could be a collapse of major European banks. This inevitable contagion and its potential consequences for the European financial system is the reason the European Central Bank is determined to avoid a default at this time. That was Martin Feldstein. PIMCO's Mohamed El Arian. For the next 3 years, we're going to see different economies work out different problems. For European economies, especially Greece, it would be through default, he said in a press conference in Taipei. Nothing has been done to enhance growth. No single Greek indicator has shown strength. German Chancellor Angela Merkel threw in her two cents concerning one of the tangential risks of this crisis, that being the impact of credit default swaps, CDS contracts that represent insurance against a default. Nobody around the globe knows exactly who holds those papers and what it means if they come due, Merkel told a German parliamentary committee, and it was unclear who will have to pay how much and who will need fresh capital in that way. Plus, Merkel added, there isn't any transparency in this part of the investment universe. Where have you heard that before? Here. Merkel mentions the potential need for fresh capital, so following is some bank data from Bloomberg. French lenders had the highest overall foreign claims on Greek borrowers of $56.7 billion, including $15 billion in public debt. As the latest from the Bank for International Settlements shows, French banks had $589.8 billion of loans tied to Ireland, Italy, Portugal, and Spain. German lenders were the biggest foreign owners of Greek government debt with $22.7 billion in holdings last year and had the second most overall claims, the BIS said. Their claims on Ireland, Italy, Portugal, and Spain amounted to $498.8 billion. The two countries hold more than 60% of all foreign claims on Greece, according to BIS data. Separately, also from Bloomberg, independent CreditView, a Swiss ratings company, said in a stress test study earlier this month that 33 of Europe's biggest banks would need $347 billion of additional capital by the end of 2012 to boost their tangible common equity to 10% from 9.1% at the end of 2010. An S&P stress test published in March estimated European banks would need as much as 250 billion euros, or the same $350 billion, in fresh capital if faced with a sharp increase in yields and a severe economic decline. Political economist Spiros Economides of the London School of Economics told the New York Times that when it comes to Greece and Papandreou's efforts, quote, "The main problem is that he's only been able to deliver on the parts of the austerity package that are easily enforceable and transparent and irrevocable, such as cuts to public sector salaries and pensions. Unfortunately, the rest of it is a complete mess. It's very easy to legislate. The problem is to enforce legislation. There's no enforcement mechanism." Ah, yes, implementation. In the 13 months under EU IMF supervision under the first bailout, Greece has missed every spending and revenue target. The coming austerity, too, if approved, won't help a lick. Greece has long deserved what it is suffering through today. The issue is, does it drag down everyone else in Europe as well as ourselves with it? Turning to the United States, a Bloomberg National poll found that by a 44-34 margin, Americans say they believe they are worse off than when President Barack Obama took office in early 2009, which is really remarkable given we were in a near depression that January. More than half respondents now believe their children are destined to have a lower standard of living than they do. A full 66% of Americans think the U.S. is on the wrong track, which is higher than an ABC News Washington Post poll reading from October 1982. When unemployment was peaking at 10.8% during the 1981-82 recession. A survey for APGFK revealed that for the first time, less than 50% of respondents say Obama deserves re-election. 4 out of 5 in this one believe the economy is in poor shape, with 36% calling it very poor, a new high in APGFK polling. But Obama's job approval rating is 52% in the AP survey. As for the economic data this week, the figure on May durable goods, big ticket items, was up a solid 1.9% for this highly volatile barometer, but weekly jobless claims continue to hold above the important 400,000 barrier, and the latest figures on existing and new home sales for May were hardly anything to crow about. The Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee met this week and opted again to hold the line on interest rates at zero for the now all too familiar extended period, meaning savers will continue to get screwed. Ben Bernanke and company also lowered their growth forecast for the U.S. economy from April's forecast of 3.1 to 3.3% down to 2.7 to 2.9%, while the projected unemployment rate for 2012 is 7.8 to 8.2%, which one would think would be a killer for President Obama's re-election hopes. The Fed also offered for the first time that it was mildly concerned about the rise in commodity prices, but the chairman later said he still felt these were transitory, and this week commodities got crushed. One thing he did mention that was new was his belief that any thoughts of deflation are now off the table, which, given his track record on the forecasting side, means it's back on. I'm running a series on Bernanke and Greenspan's moves at the Fed on my Wall Street History link, worth a reminder just how awful our chairmen have been at times. The thing is, the Fed, as well as other central banks around the world, have few options left when it comes to juicing the economy. So they surprised the markets this Wednesday when, in coordination with the International Energy Agency, announced they would release 60 million barrels of oil, 50% of this from America's Strategic Petroleum Reserve of 727 million barrels that is supposed to be for genuine emergencies and or supply shocks, such as in the case of Hurricane Katrina. The IEA explained that the 1.5 million barrels per day that has been lost due to the Libyan civil war, coupled with the normal seasonal increase in refiner demand expected for this summer, will exacerbate the shortfall further. Greater tightness in the oil market threatens to undermine the fragile global economic recovery, said the IEA. Oil in the futures pits promptly took a header, Even though all are in agreement, there really is no shortage of crude, and oil had been moving off its recent $100 base anyway. But at least for a few days, the move by the IEA and the politicians had the desired effect. It's just that the move smacks of desperation and hypocrisy, at least here in the U.S., as the Wall Street Journal opined. One irony is that 1 million barrels a day, that's our share of 30 million spaced over 1 month, is about how much oil experts believe we could be producing from the vast oil fields in Alaska's wildlife reserve. President Obama has said that tapping Alaska wouldn't affect oil prices, but now says a temporary spurt will do so. How about opening up Alaska and dropping the de facto Gulf moratorium too? That was the Wall Street Journal. Of course, when it comes to the U.S., this next month, it's really all about the debt ceiling and what Congress and the administration are going to do about it. Earlier in the week, Senator Kent Conrad, Democrat, North Dakota, a key figure in the deficit talks, said the goal of slicing more than $2 trillion from the federal budget by 2021 falls short of what's needed, adding, quote, most serious observers would tell you that it takes a package of at least $4 trillion to fundamentally change the trajectory we're on. In the context of our debt, which is nearly $15 trillion and is headed for $25 trillion, $2 trillion over 10 years does not do the job. To those who say just raise the debt ceiling by the August 2nd deadline and then tackle the deficit later, Conrad argues all incentive would then be lost. Quote, if they reach an agreement and that passes and the debt limit then does not have to be dealt with until after next year's election, there will be very little appetite here to come back and do what really has to be done to get our financial house in order. But on Thursday, Republican House Majority Leader Eric Cantor and Republican Senator John Kyle walked out of Vice President Biden's budget talks, citing an impasse over tax increases. Republicans such as Senator Mitch McConnell said it's up to the president to join the discussions. Where is he? Asked McConnell. What does he propose? What is he willing to do to reduce the debt and to avoid this crisis that's building on his watch? He's the one in charge. I think most Americans think it's about time he started acting like it. So that's where we stand, at an impasse, though Obama is indeed going to join the talks on Monday. My bet has been that a deal will be cut, which, upon close inspection, will essentially be a sham and not well received by the markets, after perhaps an initial relief rally. We'll then have our own Greece-type moment in 2012 and the U.S. equity market crashes, assuming Greece's parliament doesn't take us all down next week. One last item on this topic, as part of the above mentioned Bloomberg survey, by a 57-34 margin, poll respondents say they would be worse off if Republican Congressman Paul Ryan's Medicare overhaul was adopted. 58% of independents, a key voting bloc for 2012. I said from day one that Ryan's plan is flawed, but it was a courageous start. The survey results are yet another example, however, of how Americans are unwilling to sacrifice one iota when it comes to their cherished entitlements. To wit, the same Bloomberg poll has respondents saying they trust the Democrats more than Republicans to do a better job of dealing with Medicare by 43-34. Well, of course, the Democrats won't touch it. In a reversal of last week, this time the Dow Jones and S&P 500 fell anew, while NASDAQ broke its five-week losing streak, up 1.4% to 26.52. NASDAQ is now exactly unchanged on the year. Concerns over Europe, including new ones involving Italy and its banks, trumped any good news for the most part. FedEx, for example, reported better than expected earnings for its recent quarter, citing an improving global economy and growing demand. I'm not too sure about an improving economy, but I'll take them at their word on the demand side. On the other hand, giant Philips Electronics, NV, noticed it would initiate further unspecified job cuts as its European lighting business is suffering amid the slowdown there. Overall, stocks are not overvalued. I never said they were when I established my 2011 forecast of negative returns on the three key benchmarks of 5-7%. It's just that things on the earnings front are as good as they'll get, and expectations will be lowered, not raised, over the second half. That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday. For further details, go to stocksandnews.com, click on Week in Review. Have a good one. Take care.